University of New Mexico, and today I'm going to be talking about bell inequalities, a very heavily studied topic. And I really didn't intend to get into bell inequalities, but it just sort of, my research led me there, and so I'm going to present about some of the results that I have. And this is still a work in progress, so this is by no means complete. But I have some interesting results, and I think the unique part of this talk, really, because I said bell inequalities are heavily studied, is that I'm going to take a random variables approach. I'll talk about this a little bit later, but normally people think about joint probability distributions when they think about bell inequalities. But instead, I'm going to think about correlated random variables, and you get some unique insight into the problem, I think, by taking this approach. So first, I'm going to start at the very beginning, and this is local realism. This is the whole question. We're asking, when does a local realistic model for some measurements exist? And first, I want to talk about local realism because I want to make it clear exactly what I mean. So typically, we think about the following type of experiment. So these green dots represent particles. And so up at the top, you have these particles initially interacting, so we get some entangled state. And then after the entangled state is created, we let these particles fly off in their separate directions. One goes to Alice, and the other goes to Bob. And then once at Alice and Bob, Alice is allowed to make some measurements, A1, A2, so forth, and Bob can make his measurements. And really what we're interested in is, you know, these measurements A and B that Alice and Bob can make take values 1. You know, for one trial of this experiment, they take certain values 1, minus 1. And then if you repeat the experiment again, you can get another table of values, minus 1, 1, so forth. But the real importance comes when you multiply the results A and B together. And that tells you how the results are correlated. And so if you repeat this experiment many, many times, you can look at how A1 and B1 are correlated, A1 and B2 are correlated. These are average values. And after many, many trials, you get these average values, and you can compute quantities like this. And the interesting thing is, if there's a local realistic description, which I'll explain in a minute, these have stronger bounds than it turns out is true for quantum mechanics. And so the classical bounds, the maximum value these sorts of equations can get, is written as an inequality. This is less than or equal to some value. And those are Bell inequalities. And if the Bell inequality is violated, meaning that your actual expectation values are beyond that classical value, that means there is no local realistic description. So let me now talk about what I mean by local realism. First of all, I think the big point is realism. So we have this experiment. The two particles, two green dots, get entangled. And then they are sent off to the different directions. And I like to think about realism. What realism says is that each particle has attached to it this table. So each particle has its own table. And this table tells it, if I were to measure A1, then I'll output the result minus 1. If I were to measure A2, I output the result 1, and so forth. So this table tells you what values to output. Now, this violates the uncertainty principle. But the idea of realism is that these tables exist. We just could never measure A1 and A2, so we'll never know that A1 was actually negative 1 and A2 was actually 1. And likewise, Bob has its own table. And as you repeat this experiment over and over again, and you re-entangle new particles and you send them off, every time you do redo this, the table changes. So the table might initially be something like this. And then after you do this experiment several times, maybe you do it again, and the table looks something like this. And these tables change randomly. There's some local hidden variables that will tell you how the table changes, but from our perspective, this table just seems to change randomly. And then locality just means that once these tables are created and these particles are sent to their different directions, that they don't change. Once they've been created, they're fixed, and locality says they can't change. So this is the idea of local realism. So the existence, if you can model the experiment, you know, the statistics of the experiment, by considering these particles as having little tables attached to them, then there's a local realistic description. And the whole point of Bell inequalities is to figure out, when does this description exist? So typically, like I mentioned in the very beginning, the point of view that people take is of how to create these tables is by using a probability distribution, where this is the probability that A1 has outcome little a1, that the second Alice's second measurement has outcome little a2. And so if this probability distribution exists, so this probability distribution tells you the probability of having certain outcomes. If it exists, well, then I can create a table pretty easily because, you know, here's a table where A1 has a value negative 1, A2 has a value 1, and B1 has a value 1, B2 has a value negative 1. So I want, what is the probability of A1 having 1, negative 1, A2 having 1, and so forth. And then I just create these tables with this probability. So as I do this over and over again, the table is going to change, but they're going to change according to this probability distribution. So typically, people think of, there exists a local realistic description if such a probability distribution exists, because then I can create these tables. But for quantum correlations, these probability distributions don't always exist. But if a probability distribution does exist, then you can say, you know, A1 and B1 being plus 1 is just, if you want that probability, you just take the probability A1's 1, B1's 1, A1's negative 1, B1's negative 1, because those are the two outcomes that will give you a product of being plus 1. And then you sum over all the rest. And those, and the marginals of this probability distribution will then give you all the correlations, the kind of correlations we test for in an experiment. But also, like I said, the whole point of this talk is to not take this standard approach, which has been worked over very thoroughly, but to take the approach of random variables. So now these tables, each time we create it, they're going to be different instances of random variables. So here I have a measurement of A1, and associated with it is a random variable. And this random variable is either going to be plus 1 or minus 1. And each measurement has with it a random variable. And so now, each time the experiment is repeated, so these are the green dots of the particles, and this is the table associated with the particle. And each time this experiment is repeated, each time we create a new table, it's just a different instance of the random variable.
The random variable, R1 is created with equal probability of being plus 1 minus 1. You haven't said anything. Okay.
Yeah, so, I mean, A1 has a particular probability. If you have the quantum state,
okay,
and you make a measurement of the quantum state, you can get plus 1, minus 1 various probabilities. So this random variable has to take on those values for those probabilities.
I see. Oh, right, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, so in this case, maybe A1 will, maybe, you know, your state's an eigenstate of A1 with eigenvalue minus 1, in which case a measurement of A1 is always going to yield minus 1, so this random variable is always going to take the value minus 1. All right, so Bob has his random variables, which tell him the outcomes of his measurements. So for each trial, the random variables take different instances. And then we want to multiply these guys together and look at the correlations. And so in terms of random variables, what that means is the product of the random variable for Alice's measurement and the product times the random variable for Bob's measurement has to be a random variable that describes the correlation, that describes the product A1, B1. Yeah.
Previous picture.
It's exactly the same, except it's just a different approach to the same thing. Like a different road going to the same place.
Well, what's different about it then?
Well, I'm going to have some results with random variables that I can use. So I'll explain in a minute how I'm going to use random variables.
You assume that those two random variables are independent once they're created, is that it?
Sure.
I mean, if you don't assume some It looks like you assume some independence, but I'm not sure.
Well, I don't know what you mean by independent. They are correlated. I mean, so they're not.
So what's the difference between one global random variable?
So what happens is this table is created, and these particles are together, both these tables are created. And then, so they can be correlated. For example, R1 of A could be the same as R1 of B. They could have exactly the same value. They're perfectly correlated. And so, you can do that locally once you create the state, but then when these guys separate, you have one table for Alice, one table for Bob, and now, but they have their own different values.
I'm having trouble seeing why it's really more general than what you talked about before.
No, it's exactly
can't
the same.
Just, oh, it is the same.
Yeah. So I'm not going to prove it here because it's going to take too much time, but the existence of a probability distribution and the existence of random variables that create these tables are exactly equivalent.
Oh, okay.
So a probability distribution exists if and only if random variables exist. And so it's an equivalent way of thinking about local realism. But I'm going to eventually use results about random variables that will give us new results about local realism.
Well, I guess the difficulty I have is you just said a probability distribution exists if and only if random variables exist.
Yes.
So to me, that sounds like a tautology.
Okay.
I don't know that you're saying anything other than 0 equals 0 with that statement.
Well,
so maybe if you could put some spin on it so that I can see that there's a distinction between the earlier posing of the problem and this posing of the problem.
So suppose a probability distribution exists.
From that would mean a joint probability distribution over all of the random variables on both sides.
Yes. Okay. Generate random variables from that probability distribution. Right, you can do that. Assume G is a topology to be able to create random variables from the distribution.
And by that you mean sample from the probability distribution.
Sure. So RA1 will be +1 with probability P1, and then you sum over all the rest. All right, so in an equation, you'd have maybe some R1 for Alice takes the instance +1 with probability equal to, if you take the probability distribution, you sum over P1 for Alice's result, and you take A and the B's, and you sum over the A's and the B's.
Okay.
Right. So this is how you can create random variables from the probability distribution. But then now, if I give you random variables, mock up a probability distribution. And I'm saying you can do that, and so they're exactly the appropriate ones.
Random variables just need to be consistent. Like with the idea of taking marginals.
Yeah, so I'm going to define notation and stuff for random variables. So this should become more clear after I define notation. Because what does it mean to, how do you show me random variables with these properties? You need some notation for the random variables. But, once you have that, then, you can create the kind of notation. So, let me see, I think that's it. So are there any more questions? Because I'm about to move on to random variables. So is there any questions about local realism and how random variables generate local hidden variable tables? Yeah.
So it's important for local realism that you specify that the random variables are all defined on the same probability space, right? I mean, isn't that what Bell's theorem is going to show, that you can't consistently define these random variables on the same probability space?
What do you mean? So I think your question is, all these random variables come from the same joint probability distribution, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's exactly the random variables I'm considering. Okay, so I eventually want to get to Bell-Nicolas clause. I want to know when does a local realistic description for measurements exist. And in order to be able to take the random variables approach, we have to learn a little bit more about random variables. And really, there's one main result here that I want to prove about random variables. Well, I don't prove it, but I want to state about random variables. That'll pretty much be the workhorse. OK, so here's the notation I'm going to use for random variables. Given a parameter a between negative 1 and 1, the random variable, which is a script r of a, is going to take on the values plus 1 or minus 1. And the probability it's plus 1 is 1 plus a over 2, and the probability it's minus 1 is 1 minus a over 2. So these probabilities add to 1, and it makes sense that a is between negative 1 and 1, because those give you non-negative probabilities. And the rest of this slide is going to try and give you a feel about this notation. So first of all, the first obvious thing to notice, if you take the average value of the random variable, it's going to be plus 1 with this probability and minus 1 with this probability, and you just do it and you get a. So a, this parameter between minus 1 and 1, is just really the average value of the random variable. And so here's some examples of random variables, r of 1 through r of negative 1 through r of 1. And you see that if the average value is negative, these two over here, then your random variable is going to tend to be negative more often. So here's some instances. R of negative 1 is going to be negative 1 with unit probability. R of negative 1 half tends to be negative 1 most of the time, but a few 1s sprinkled in. R of 0 is a 50-50 random variable. It has average value 0, so it's going to be plus and minus 1 equally often. And then likewise, plus 1 half and 1, you just get positive. All right, so these are single random variables. And like I mentioned before, what we're really interested in is, so this would be, for example, Alice's measurement results, or Bob's measurement result would be one of these random variables. But we're really interested in what is their product. So if you write the product of two random variables, RA and RB, we're really interested in, well, RA is plus or minus 1, RB is plus or minus 1, so its product is also plus or minus 1. And so that can be considered a random variable. And we want to know what are the possible correlations. So, and you can just see here, I wrote this in parentheses to make it more clear, but P, the average value of this random variable, is just the average value of the product. RA and RB. So P is just the average value of RA times RB. And so here I've got a simple example to help you get some intuition. And it's just the case where the random variables RA and RB are uncorrelated. They're independent. So the value that RA has nothing to do with the value that RB has. In which case, you get the value plus 1, the probability that they're both plus 1, or they're both minus 1. And you get the probability minus 1, the value minus 1, the probabilities that 1's plus and 1's minus, the other way around. And so you do this math, and you just get AB. So that means that if the random variables are uncorrelated, then RA, RB is just a random variable with average value AB, so it's R of AB. But this was just sort of an example to get you more familiar with this. What we're really interested in is, oh yeah, so that's the conclusion. So what we're really interested in is these random variables can be correlated with each other. And we want to know what are the possible correlations. So to help with this, I mean, there are many ways of proving this, but I like this picture, and it'll be useful later, too. And this is to imagine the random variables as bars that I have written here of length 1. So these bars have length 1. And I've divided the bar into two sections. A plus section and a minus section. So the length of the minus section, so this is R of A, the length of the minus section is 1 minus A over 2, the same as the probability that this random variable takes value minus 1. And so really you can think of an instance of the random variable as just picking a point in this bar at random. So I'm going to pick it over here with probability 1 plus a over 2, and over here, probability 1 minus a over 2. And so I'm going to get a value plus 1 or minus 1 with the right probabilities. And so the question is, if I have two random variables and I multiply them together, what can I get? So to answer this question, so here's R of A. It's going to be plus some probability, minus some plus and minus. And I want to see, let's just do the case of how correlated can they get. So if I have these two bars, and I want to see how often can their product be plus 1, because that's what correlated means. I want them to be plus 1 as often as possible. Then what I'm going to do is I'm going to correlate, I'm going to say every time I pick a region in here, I'm going to correlate this minus region with this part of the minus region. I'm going to correlate this plus region with this plus region. And now I've picked these both to be plus as often as I can. And I'm just left with this little squiggle here where I have no choice but for them to be, the product to be minus 1. So in these two regions, I have them being plus 1 and this one minus 1. That's as correlated as these two can get. Now we can look at the other end of the spectrum. How often can the product of RA and RB be minus 1? Well, if I want to get these, the product of these two to be minus 1 as often as possible, then I just want to take the blue region over here and correlate it with the blue region over here. And then I want to correlate the plus region over here with the minus region over here. Now I've made these, the product of these two, minus as often as possible. And then I'm stuck them both being plus that much of the time. So you end up with a random variable that looks something like this. So now the only thing that's left is to say, OK, this is my representation of the random variable, and this is my representation of the random variable. What are their average values so I can write them with the notation that I had before? And when you do that, you find that this value p can be between the value I get when they're maximally correlated, which is 1 minus a minus b, and the value when they're totally anti-correlated, which is a plus b minus 1. So for two random variables, the point is, they can be correlated, and how much they can be correlated is, well, the average value of the product has to be somewhere in this range. All right, now the general case, if you have more than two random variables that you're multiplying together, is a bit more complicated, but it's really just a generalization of the formula we had for two. Instead of this 1, or these 1s, it becomes n minus 1, because we had 2 before, so 2 minus 1 is 1. Instead of a plus b, you just have the sum of the magnitudes of all of them. Instead of a minus b, you just have the sum of all of them minus the last one. And then there's this pesky sign thing, which I wouldn't worry about. The point is, for if you multiply together n random variables, you get a range of values for p that's more or less the generalization we found for 2. OK, so this is the main result I need about random variables, about how they can be correlated. So before I move on to actually get to the main point of the talk, which is to derive some Bell inequalities, are there any questions about this? Yeah.
And the intuition for under what, for what values of a1, a2, et cetera, that inequality is sort of, you know, squeezes p most and least tightly? When can
you? Yeah. If you have large values of the a's, you know, if all the a's are 1, right, then this is n minus 1 is 1. And this is n minus 1 minus n, which is n minus 2. And so n minus 1 minus n minus 2 is also 1. So it's 1's less than equal to p is less than equal to 1. So if these are all 1's, you have no choice. P has to be 1. And generally, if these guys are very large, we can get a very small range. But if these are small, like these are 0, which is the best you can get, if you fit the random variable, it gives you the most freedom in how you can correlate it, then you can usually have a very big range.
So if your random variables have very low entropy, then they can't be very correlated. Is that right? There's not too much range in it.
50-50 random variables, entropy, yeah, small. So yes, that's right. And also, the more random variables you have, the more freedom you have, tend to have with correlation. If I have a small number in, I tend to be more restricted in how I correlate. Yeah.
So it looks like the inequality itself is fairly symmetric with respect to the subscripts, except for n. So does that mean the theorem is actually true so long as a sub n is the smallest? Or am I missing something?
Yes. It's actually true if a sub n is small. So I've ordered them.
So that ordering isn't strictly necessary as long as a sub n is the smallest?
Yes. Yeah. So it doesn't matter about the whole thing, just a n is the smallest. Yeah. And in particular, if a n is 0, if you have one random variable that's a 50-50 random variable, then it's exactly symmetric. And you can just get rid of the sign thing because it doesn't matter. Any other questions? All right, so let's do what I came here to do and derive some Bell inequalities. When does a local realistic description exist? All right, so our picture is we have these two particles. If they get entangled, and then one goes off to Alice, one goes off to Bob. And now to get a question that was asked before is, so we know if Alice measures A1, her random variable has to have average value, the average value of A1. And A2 has to have average value of A2, and so forth. So you know what these random variables are. Likewise, you know what Bob's are too. The only question is, how are they correlated with each other? And so once you have these tables and these random variables, you can actually list the correlations that are required. The random variable for A1 and random variable for B1 need to multiply to give you a random variable with average value of A1, B1, right? So here I've done the example where there's two measurements for Alice and two measurements for Bob. So in that case, there's just four equations that you need to satisfy. You need to find random variables that will satisfy these four equations. And if you can find such random variables, then a local realistic description exists. And if no such random variables exist, then no local realistic description for those measurements exists. So I'm now going to explain the strategy that we're going to take. So imagine you had just, these are sort of funny equations I want to satisfy. They're products of random variables that have to give me other random variables. But imagine there's something more familiar, like a system of linear equations. Well, then what you, the standard approach you would take is to take linear combinations of those equations to eliminate certain variables, and you could write it in matrix form. If the determinant of the matrix is not zero, there would exist a solution. And then by taking linear combinations, you get other equations that would be much easier to solve. And that's sort of something like the approach we're going to take here. I want to know when does a solution exist to these four equations. So my version of linear combinations is just going to be products. I'm going to multiply these equations together in various ways and get new equations that I then want to solve, or try and find random variables that will solve them. Now, the original idea was that, well, if I can satisfy these equations just by themselves, just this single equation, and I can satisfy all equations that are consequences of these, meaning I can multiply these equations together in any way and satisfy all of those equations, well, then I should be able to find random variables. Because I can correlate random variables to satisfy these, and I can correlate random variables to satisfy any correlations I can get from these, so I should be able to find random variables. Turns out there's a slight hitch to that, but let me show you exactly what I'm talking about, because it might not be clear just from words. So here are the equations I want to satisfy. I want to find random variables to satisfy those four equations. So one consequence of those four equations is this bottom one. What I've done is I've just multiplied the four together. if a solution exists to these four equations, then a solution must exist to the product of all four of them. When I multiply these together, these Van der variables go away, and the RB1s go away, and these two go away, and then these two go away. So you just have one on the left-hand side. And then on the right-hand side is just the product of these four. So certainly a necessary condition for a solution of these equations to exist is for this bottom equation to have a solution. And if you consider all other ones, like if I just consider multiplying these two, or multiplying these two and this one, or if I consider all combinations, and if all of those equations can be satisfied, then a local realistic description should exist. But it turns out that all the other ways of multiplying these equations together don't give you anything worth thinking about. This is the only one that actually gives a real constraint. But from our aside on random variables, we know when we can correlate these guys to one, because we know what we can correlate these guys to. So I'll remind you of the theorem we had. If you write this one as just R of one, then R of P can equal a product of random variables if and only if P is in this range that I wrote down before. So if you just translate this theorem I had before to this equation up here, you get that, you get this. Now, let me make sure. Okay, so the statement is you can find random variables to correlate to one if and only if these two inequalities are satisfied. All right, so this is a necessary condition. Well, the if and only if has to do with these four random variables can be correlated to one if and only if this is true. Now, a local realistic description exists. This is necessary. You know, if this is not satisfied, if I cannot correlate these four variables to one, then no random variables exist. There's no local realistic description.
But you also say that other products that one could have written down add nothing. I think you said something like that. So
So this is the only one that you really need to think about.
So then why is this just necessary and not also sufficient?
I don't know. But I'm going to give an example later.
Okay.
But here in this inequality, there's the very last term, minus A2, B2, is special.
This should be a parentheses around all four of these. It should be minus, 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 plus. There should be a parentheses here.
Okay, In any case, one of them is picked out as being different. So presumably you could have done it in different ways.
Yeah.
So that would give you four more inequalities, perhaps? In order to completely specify the sort of area in which probability correlations can exist, you need I think four or eight inequalities. So it looks like.
Yeah. So like you said, there are more inequalities here. Because of these signs, right? Different values, the signs give you different inequalities. And also because this is really just the smallest one, so depending on what correlation you have, it's the smallest one. But actually, I mean, you can look at this. Suppose that these this is one. And I was going to talk about this in a little bit. Suppose this is one. Then, I mean, you can see that, you know, how big can this get? Well, this can get as big as four for those four terms. And so this can get as big as one. So this is one, this left-hand side is automatically satisfied. And you just have to worry about the right-hand one. And so this is sort of a very raw form. This is just directly applying the theorem I had before and getting the condition. And I'm going to distill this down to something simpler in a little bit. But I was going to do it for the general case. Here I just considered two measurements for each party, but I was going to do the general case. So this is a good stopping point if there are any more questions.
Oh. Yeah. So when you say the last term corresponds to the smallest one, does that mean, that's a bit odd, because the standard bound inequalities don't have any such constraints on which term is which. Whereas it seems here you have to impose a constraint.
Well, standard bound inequality, you need to put the minus sign on all four. Make
well,
sure.
One of them has a different sign to the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you have to check all four. So you can put that different sign in four in each four.
But regardless of where you put it, the inequalities are true.
Yeah.
For any yeah. conceivable correlation.
Okay, so I see your question. Yeah. So sort of getting a little ahead is this actually. I mean, it is actually not too surprising, considering two measurements for each party, that this turns out to be exactly the CHSH inequality. So it turns out that when you take into account these signs and you do all the possible cases, you just get all the CHSH variations.
A priori, it looks a little different because you wouldn't have all those absolute value signs.
In yeah, exactly. So,
there must be the combination of those signs.
Yeah, and if you try and get rid of these absolute value signs and take into account these signs, you just get all the
things. I can believe that.
Yeah. All right, so, but this definitely goes beyond just two measurements. In fact, it goes beyond two qubits, too. I can imagine any arbitrary number of qubits with any arbitrary number of measurements apiece. And all I need to do is, you know, I pick a measurement for Alice, I pick a measurement for Bob, I pick a measurement for all the others, and they need to multiply together to give me their average value needs to be the average value of that measurement, considered as just a joint measurement. So here, ML is AJ, tensor, BK, tensor, and so forth. And so, in the general case, you just get a bunch of equations like this. I put dots because they're just more than I would want to write. But the point is, and the point is very simple, if I can find random variables to satisfy all these equations, then a local realistic description exists. And so, like I argued before, if, you know, any subset of these, so there's a big list of equations here, if any subset of these multiplies to give you an equation which I can satisfy, then this should be a sufficient condition. You know, intuitively it should be a sufficient condition because I can get all the correlations. And when I multiply a subset of these together, in general what I get is R1 on the left-hand side, and then I get a product of these measurements. It should be average values there. I get a product of these random variables on the right equals R1. So exactly the same as what I did before. All I've done is I've generalized two qubits and two measurements to any number of qubits and any number of measurements.
I have a question. Why happens if the number of measurements are odd?
It shouldn't matter whether it's odd or even.
I mean, you get a different number on the.
So, you mean if you multiply equations? So, okay. Let me answer that actually with the simpler one. So, the question is instead of multiplying all four, I could have just multiplied the first three. Then I'd have A2 occurring once, and there'd be left over A2.
Something like that.
Yeah. So, in that case, you can just consider a measurement of A2 and then identity, right? So you get R of A2 is equal to R of A2 tensor the identity, and you can just add and you can just add that in and multiply these four. In other words, if you have a leftover measurement here, you can just multiply it over the right hand side, and so you still have a part of the measurements for one. So yeah, if you sort of chose unwisely and had leftover measurements straggling here, you can multiply them over. In every situation I can think of, if you have leftover measurements here, it's not going to give you any constraints. You always want these guys to go away in order to actually have something that you have to worry about. Okay, but anyway, if you multiply together these equations and you get things like this, you can then just use the theorem about random variables and translate it into an inequality like we had before. And like I was saying before, if this signs all multiply to 1, then this left-hand side is trivially satisfied. And we only have to consider the right-hand side. If these signs multiply to negative 1, then likewise, the right-hand side then is trivial, because this is always bigger than negative 1. And so we only have to worry about this left inequality. And so you can just, the first simplification you can make is just say, okay, well, if these signs multiply to 1, then I want to use the case where this is a different sign. And in the case that this multiplies to negative 1, I want to use the case where they're all the same sign. So I just say, this is 1, now these have a different sign. And if this is negative 1, these have the same sign. And then the right-hand side just turns out to be n minus 2. So this bottom equation is just exactly equivalent to these top equations. I just got rid of the useless inequality. And so this is it. This is, you know, you pick your measurements, m, and you know these m depend on which of these equations you're multiplying together. And once you pick them, you can write this inequality, and this is a Bell inequality. This has to be satisfied in order for a local realistic description to exist. And so I keep on bringing up this question of, okay, but are these sufficient? You know, do these random variables exist if this inequality is satisfied? And I don't know the answer to that question. And I don't want to talk about it next. But before I go on, this is sort of the main result of the talk, really. You know, I've taken random variables, and I've multiplied them. And so I've taken random variables, and I want to know when do random variables exist. And I found that, well, this needs to be true in order for random variables to exist. And so these are my Bell inequalities. Are there any questions about this before I start explaining a few extra results that really just have to do with applying this to different situations?
You said something about going beyond qubits, sort of.
No, going beyond 2 qubits.
I thought you also said, yeah, I know you said that.
So
I thought you qubits. Also said there was a way to generalize this beyond qubits.
No, the reason you can't.
I mean, I don't see it, but I'm asking.
Yeah, the reason I haven't is because the result that I got this from was that theorem involving random variables, if they count values plus 1 minus 1.
Yeah, I thought you were implying there was a generalization.
So if there was a generalization to that, then you could just, you know, use that new theorem. But yeah, I don't know it. So this, as it is just restricted to qubits.
I'm also kind of confused. You said that you would multiply across,
mm-hmm.
right? Wouldn't that increase your n?
No, n is just the number of qubits. So n is
number of measurements.
Well, yeah, the number of.
Yeah, you're right.
That was a clarification. It is the number of measurements. So, increasing the number of measurements, increasing the number of things you multiply increases this right-hand side.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly.
So, if you have a lone measurement on the identity,
mm-hmm.
and you multiply across, you would get.
You would get the magnitude of the measurement has to be less than 1.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just pick one thing.
Yeah, but n would increase, but and the actual, you wouldn't get as good a bound, would you?
Well,
there are more terms in the sum.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are more terms in the sum. Both sides increase. And
yeah, but say that you have a measurement which has mean zero. And you would.
I think this next slide will help.
Okay.
So let's just consider the case of two qubits again. And Alice has some number of measurements, Bob has some number of measurements. So now I'm not just doing the two measurement case. Two qubits, arbitrary number of measurements. I'm going to write down the first few cases of this. So if you, one and two are just trivial, and one gives you a negative. Well, one gives you negative for that. So the first interesting case is if you pick three measurements and multiply them together. So I picked the measurements AJ, BK, and then the product AJ, BK. And you get, this is the inequality you get. And you just pick three, multiply them together. And it turns out that this is always satisfied. You know, if I pick a quantum state and you can just prove, I guess for two qubits, these are 4x4 matrices. So you can just do it in the general case and say, and see that this is always less than one. So then the next highest case is if you pick four measurements and multiply them together. So I pick the measurements AJBK, AIBL, AJBK, and AJBL. And so this is the equation you get. The right-hand side increases by one, and you get four terms. And then this came up before, so this isn't a surprise, but this inequality is exactly equivalent to the CHSH inequality. So actually, as you increase the number of measurements you pick, you get a less trivial inequality. But if you continue and do the case n equals 5, n equals 6, n equals 7, so forth, then, it's easy. Anyone can see that the general form, if the general form is true, if this general inequality is true, then the special case of n equals 4 is also true. That's obvious. But you can actually show that if the special case of n equals 4 is true, then the general case is also true. So that gets to your question that anything beyond n equals 4 is sort of a trade-off, where if n is too small, the inequality is pointless. But if n is too big, then it just follows from the n equals 4 case. And so actually, for the case of two qubits, all I've written down here with this somewhat messy equation is the CHSH inequality. So all of these inequalities for the case of two qubits. Yeah.
I'm sorry, before this slide, everything you said was pertaining to any system on which you're performing measurements with exactly two outcomes. And so qubits are the most natural.
On this?
Natural. Well, the talk up to this point, up to that slide, you're just talking about two measurements with two outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
In which context qubits are a natural system to think about.
Mm-hmm.
But equally, it could be a Q trick.
Sure, if you just pick a Q over one with two outcomes.
Is the analysis you just presented on that slide just now specific to qubits? Or any quantum system where you're just performing two outcome measurements?
So this wouldn't. So if AI was a POVM element, a two outcome POVM element, BK was a two outcome POVM element, and AKBK product is a two outcome POVM element, then I would say yes. But I haven't thought about that, so there might be some caveats about when this applies, but. Yeah, if everything's just too outcome, then it should apply. So anyway, it seems that I've gone through all this work, and for two qubits, all I got from all my work was just the CHSH inequality. But of course, bone inequalities are hard to come by, so you know, for three qubits, you do get inequalities that are not equivalent to the CHSH inequality, and four qubits and so forth, you get a bunch of new ones. And the conjecture is, my conjecture is that if you have k qubits, for two qubits, I just considered four measurements multiplying together. So for k qubits, you need to consider up to 2 to the k measurements you multiply together. Anything beyond that just follows from the lower bounds of n. Okay, so I keep on saying this, but the big question that I'm thinking about now is this, or are these inequalities that I came up with sufficient for local realist description to resist? And if they were, then the CHSH inequality would be sufficient for local realist description to exist for measurements on two qubits. So let me see. I have 11 seconds. So let me just say that if you allow arbitrary correlations, so now just get rid of quantum mechanics. You just say these are your measurements and these are correlations. Whether it comes from a quantum state or not, I don't know. Then you can get situations where my inequalities give you certain restrictions, and that this is no restriction at all. This is negative 1 to 1. So my correlation, my inequalities give you no restriction, where in actuality you get that the actual restriction is something very specific. So the point is that if you just allow arbitrary correlations, my inequalities are not sufficient. You can have, so for example, two qubits, you can have arbitrary correlations that satisfy all the CHSH inequalities, but there does not exist a local realist description. But I'm interested in quantum mechanics. I want to know about quantum correlations. So really the question is, if you're restricting yourself to a quantum state, or you're restricting yourself to the subset of correlations that come from quantum mechanics, is the CHSH inequality sufficient for two qubits? Yeah.
For example, work also if the mean value of each separate measurement is zero?
Well,
I sort of thought that CHSH was sufficient in that case, but maybe I'm remembering.
Yeah. So this example, the mean value is not zero. And you might be right. I mean, I don't know the result you're talking about, but just thinking about it, it seems that to get a counterexample of CHSH, you have to have a non-zero for each individual one. But anyway, that's the sort of anticlimactic because I skipped through this example. But really, the big question is, are these inequalities that I came up with sufficient for correlations that come from quantum states, measurements on quantum states? And this is a very hard question because my conditions are not sufficient in general for general correlations. So it's a tough question that I'm very interested in knowing the answer to. But the upside is that I do have a big class of inequalities that apply to an arbitrary number of qubits and to an arbitrary number of measurements per qubit. And that for two qubits just reduced to the CHSH inequality. So, any final questions?
Thanks, Pat.
Are you familiar with the chained inequalities of Boston and Capes?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if your inequality, at least special case for two, parties, is equivalent to the chained inequalities.
So the Brownstein case inequalities, the chained ones, are exactly a subset of my inequalities for two qubits. And so they just reduce to the CHSH inequality too.
Okay. A subset. Okay.
Yeah, they're a subset of mine. And therefore equivalent to them. Yeah.
This looks familiar to me, and it appeared in a paper by Hess and Philip.
And what they say is that the Bell theorem is just a special case of an old theorem by this Vorobev guy in probability theory, where he asked, given a bunch of marginal probability distributions, can they arise from a global probability distribution? And so similar question, do random variables exist if you postulate some marginal probabilities for them?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess he gave necessary and sufficient conditions for this. And in that paper, they show that the four original Bell inequalities are necessary and sufficient for these four random variables to be defined on a common probability space.
So for two measurements for Alice and two measurements for Bob, CHSH is necessary and sufficient. But for more than two measurements, actually the general thought is that for more than two measurements, CHSH is not sufficient. So I'm thinking it might be sufficient, but as far as I know, it's an open question. And the first part of your question is, many people have written down all the Bell inequalities. I mean, all the Bell inequalities, it's fairly easy to write down. The point is, we want to have some finite or some small set. Because if you write down all the Bell inequalities, you just get an infinite number, and it's a very hard problem to solve. So we want like special cases, two qubits, three qubits. You know, what are the necessary sufficient conditions?
Mm-hmm. Have you tried an approach from algebraic geometry where you could write down a polynomial basis for the space of Bell inequalities? Is that even possible in this case? It seems like it might be.
Well, all the Bell inequalities are just linear combinations.
Right. But there's this theorem called the Hilbert basis theorem. So they should be generated from some finite basis of polynomials. So,
what do you mean generated? You mean like taking linear combinations of polynomials?
Well, they won't necessarily be linear combinations, but I mean, one can imagine a subspace is defined by a system of linear equations. So, a finite number of linear equations. So more generally, is it true in this case, I think it is, that you just need some finite number of basis polynomials? Because it might be possible for the smaller numbers to calculate a nice basis. There's this standard basis called the Bergner basis. I don't know.
Well,
that would generate these. That would sort of be the way to then generate them, because then it would just be the space of Bell inequalities would just be the ideal generated by this.
Yeah, generated by that basis.
Yes.
And ideally, you might have to subtract. That'll mess up the inequalities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, something like that is exactly what you're looking for.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to understand the big question a bit more. I'm not sure if I do. So you can algorithmically derive all Bell inequalities without any mention of quantum theory. And those inequalities, strictly speaking, have nothing to do, especially doing quantum theory. And in that case, I think as you said, we know that if you have three, if you have more than two. More than two possible measurements, I think we know that there exist additional inequalities.
Yeah.
I think that's been shown.
That's been shown. I think, here's a reference where they show.
It's been more exhaustive treatments list you can sort of go about. The locality constraints are linear constraints. And you can go about using some sort of linear inequality programming. You can turn those into inequalities, get all of the inequalities. So that question is clear. But now you're saying you want sufficient for quantum theory.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to understand what that means. I mean, the inequalities either are or aren't violated by quantum theory. What exactly does that question mean?
So, you know, quantum, not all correlations are allowed by quantum mechanics.
Right.
For example, the extreme value of the CHSH inequality is actually 4. You can have a PR box, a non-local box, which will actually give you the value 4. So not all correlations are allowed by quantum mechanics. And actually, the correlations given in this paper that for which the CHSH inequalities are not sufficient, I have done a lot of searching and haven't been able to find the quantum states and measurements that will give me those statistics.
So it seems that to violate those inequalities.
That will give me the. So in the paper they give you, they say you have Alice, you have Bob, and then measurements will give you, and they give you the statistics that the measurement results give you. And they say these statistics satisfy the CHSH inequality, but there is no local realistic description. And so I went on to try and find the quantum states that were giving the statistics that they presented in the paper. And after a long search, I wasn't able to find any quantum state that would. So my guess is that no quantum state exists that would give me those correlations.
But that's not quite your question. Your question is not what statistics can be reached by quantum correlations, but rather something to do with Bell's inequalities and quantum correlations. So I'm guessing which Bell's inequalities. I mean, for example, with CHSH, you can get up to 4. But nevertheless, you can also get up to 2 root 2. So that's validated by quantum theory. So
if you sort of think of all the allowed correlations, if there are, you know, some number of measurements on analysis system, some measurements of Bob system, think of the set of all correlations. This is everything. Quantum mechanics is only a subset. And we know for the whole set, CHSH is not sufficient. But I'm just interested, for what about the things in here? If you restrict yourself to considering only correlations in here, is CHSH sufficient in that case?
Sufficient for what?
Sufficient for a local realistic description to exist.
Sufficient for hidden variables.
Okay.
So you're saying if you have these correlations which satisfy your inequalities, and if you know they came from a quantum system, then they could have also come from a classical system,
yeah,
according to a local realistic problem.
Okay, nice.
Is that true?
Yeah, I sort of envision it like the quantum predictions are this nice round thing, and the classical local realistic predictions is a simplex inside the quantum.
Like
So it has corners and stuff.
Yeah.
It has to get such a quantum thing, because you can't reach every.
Yeah, exactly. I'm pretty sure this comes out. And it's come down.
It doesn't look like a simplex. It's projected down.
It's a fully token.
And the Bellian inequalities could be the straight edges.
Pieces.
Yeah. So what you're asking is if your set of inequalities really. The limits.
Yeah, so these are all CHSH, and then maybe these are the extra ones that are beyond CHSH. Yeah. So that's the question.
Naively, it looks like the boundary of the curve in that diagram.
Yeah,
it's heuristic.
That's very heuristic, but I'm saying, but it is true that the set of quantum states is this. This boundary can't be characterized as not political.
No. Yeah.
It's got a continuous boundary. And so if you do have a situation like this where you're trying to characterize the intersection of UN and local, it doesn't look to me like it's going to be a finite set of linear inequalities.
It could be a finite set of nonlinear inequalities.
Sure.
It'll be different to characterize the quantum correlations that can be described by local inequality models.
Yeah, so you have to describe the intersection of QM and that on the table. That's the thing you have to do. But some of this boundary is going to be continuous.
I have a different question. Uh-huh. Well, I will also use random variables when I talk about that inequalities always. But I use the triangle inequality for expectation values or for probability distributions. What is the relation of your inequality to regular triangle inequality?
You mean
the theorem?
This one?
Yeah. I see some sort of connection, but I can't really make it out without pen and paper.
I think. Let me see. The triangle inequality, so you're thinking of. Something like this. But
no linear. No. I think the other way around.
I think he wants absolute value.
That's equal. I want absolute value A plus absolute value B.
Yeah, he wants
A plus
the absolute
B.
Value of the sum is less than the sum of the absolute value of the sum.
So what's the relation of this to this?
Yeah, that's what I use when I produce closed Clausius inequalities. That's the inequality in closed Clausius inequalities. I was wondering.
So is this the relation, the more general? Yeah. Because in this one you have sums of absolute values.
Yeah. Okay. I think. The problem I'm meeting is that you have A is it's a linear relation or an affine relation to the probability, whereas I usually write it straight from the probabilities. But that might be the case, the reason for these things.
I'm not sure if this answered your question or not, but there is a much simpler derivation of this lower equation that goes. If you just considered numbers between that are equal to plus 1 or minus 1, then this is just something that you can write down and it's true. You just try A and B are plus or minus 1, and you do all different combinations. You always get this. And then if you take average values of this, you get the equation. And then I think in order to go from here, the average value of this, to this, you might need something like the triangle inequality. That might be a connection.
Okay, well, let's save it's getting a little late. Let's save further questions for Matt King. He's here till when? Are you here till Matt?
Thursday,
and he's in Ray Laplante's office. So, yeah, go by and talk. Thanks, Matt.